The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Oh, good morning. Our first morning here at Wisdom House. It feels a little unfamiliar because we've, for so many years, had our summer ongos at the Grail. But actually, earlier than going to the Grail, the Village Zendo came here. I received my Dharma transmission here. And in 1997, I held my first Jukai ceremony here. And there's a few people who were in that ceremony that are still here today. Isn't that cool? So... And very famously in 2003, we had the Three Crones retreat here. And a lot of people came. Seisen Sensei and Joan Halifax came and joined me, and we were the Three Crones. That was fun. I don't know who thought of that, but it was a great idea. So here we are again, back in Litchfield, Connecticut. I did a little research to find out who was here before the Europeans. It's always good to remember that, you know. The Scaticook natives, they were from the Algonquin linguistic family, much as our Lenape people from New York City, same linguistic family, but definitely a different group of people. And they lived in the woodlands around here. This was all woods. Their name means, Scaticook means gathered waters. And it's referring to the Housatonic River and the Ten Mile River. That Housatonic River is so polluted now that you can't swim or fish in it, and has been for many years. Monsanto, PCBs, all the way in the silt, all the way through the river. GE had a transformer factory there. And so this river that was fished by these people cannot be fished, can't be swam in, can't be drunk from. And 30 miles from here, on the New York border, is where their reservation is. It's subject to much litigation. This poor tribe of people have had so much intermarriage and oppression that even their status as a tribe has been in question. And there's litigation going on about that now, the 400 acres that they have along the border. So, of course, I'm telling you this because this is the time when suddenly we've begun aware all over the country of these issues about, when the Europeans came here, we just took the land away from people and oppressed them. And so that's become something that people are paying attention to now, that separateness. And as you may know, I went on a Zen Peacemaker retreat just last week. I just got back in South Dakota, in the Black Hills, and the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation. The native story is much like it is here. The tribe is replete with alcoholism and meth addiction, extreme poverty. You think the Bowery is bad? Take a look at that beautiful land and the great poverty that's there. And we met with a group of people, native peoples, who were trying to resurrect the Lakota language. They said they had a beautiful language, but were forbidden to speak it until 1968. Part of the rules were that they weren't allowed to use the Lakota language. But now they're trying to revive that and encourage the young people to have pride in their background, in their roots. And it was lovely to see that new energy. And there was a youth center where there were arts going on and an attempt to stop this tragic sadness that you see in the tribal, in the Sioux tribes. And it wasn't far from Pine Ridge, just 100 miles. And while I was there, I learned about the Lakota concept of the portal. You may know something about portals. It's a spiritual doorway to another realm. A portal can be above us or below us. And it might be physical. Like I climbed a little mountain that was said to be a portal. A river can be a portal. Or any entry way to enter to a new way of experiencing reality. But in order to make use of portals, according to the native tradition, you have to recognize them. You have to know that, oh, this is a portal. And then organize yourself to move through it. Which sounds like Sesshin to me. When we realize that we are at the same time our ordinary self with all our ordinary shit, and also part of something much greater, intimately related to everything. Wholly, the very oneness that we're seeking, we're already there. So you could say that the portal for 21st century Western style Buddhists is Zazen. Zazen and ritual and community. These are our elements that create our portal, allow us to enter into a deeply relational space, recognizing our difference, our individuality, our relatedness, and our non-duality, our oneness. So I do think this is what Sesshin offers us if we pay attention. If we can accept that gift, accept the opening that's there. And realize that, you know, our ordinary life is the ground from which we enter the oneness. Is not separate. So this is the basic teaching, as I understand it, of the Vimalakirti Sutra. Simply that it's in our ordinary life that enlightenment occurs. And you probably know that the Vimalakirti Sutra is our study text for this Ango, and as well as the entire autumn season. So we're going to give the Vimalakirti Sutra a long study period, like from now until December. So we will have time to really let it sink in. I love it. It's one of my favorite sutras. And you'll see from the talks during this session that are given by the senior students and Ryotan Sensei that it's really relevant to our lives right now. It's a powerfully important sutra. And it does talk about how it's in our ordinary life, you know. We forget that. We're in the subway and we're walking down the street and, you know, it just let the Vimalakirti Sutra be with you at these times. You see some poor homeless guy throw some trash on the ground. Just be Vimalakirti in that moment. See what you can do. how you can not judge, how you can open your heart to compassion, and yet take care of what needs to be taken care of. This tendency we have to separate, is all we have to do is look at what's happening in this, in our country and around the world right now, where everyone is separating from everyone else. My people, my tribe. Racism, classism. Religious and cultural bias. So that's another reason why I selected the Vimalakirti Sutra. So I think it has teachings for us in terms of what's happening now. In her Harvard lectures, Toni Morrison argues that one function of racism is to identify an outsider in order to define ourselves. We make that, now I know who I am. She says, it's when the sense of self is weak or fearful that it produces what she calls the thrill of belonging. The thrill, you are the other and I belong to this. I love that phrase, the thrill of belonging. Consider what it's like to be in such a frightened place, that you can only exist in relation to casting out someone else. You can only exist because you're casting out someone else. You're being defined by the other that you're creating, really. So, in the past few months, I visited the slave quarters with Ryotan Sensei, Joshin Sensei, Myoko. In slave quarters in Alabama and Arkansas. And in preparation for that Lakota retreat, I really didn't know very much about our experience with Native Americans, and so read a few horrific books of history. It is appalling, really, if you study it. So I feel a little bit like Shariputra now. In the Vimalakirti Sutra, Shariputra says to the Buddha, he can't understand how there could be a Buddha, how there could be enlightenment, how could there be any of this in this painful, sorrowful world that we live in. You know, how can you get up in the morning, essentially? In his words, and this is in the Burton Watson translation, if this world we live in is so filled with greed, anger, and ignorance, with war and violence, how could our Buddha be pure? So the Buddha, hearing this, says to him, so what do you think? Are the sun and moon impure? Is that why the blind man fails to see him? Shariputra says, no, that is the fault of the blind man. The sun and moon are not to blame. You got to love Shariputra. He's the fall guy in this entire sutra. So great. But the point is that he's saying it's not the fault of this person who's seeing. And as they continue the dialogue, Buddha says, it is the failing of living beings that prevent them from seeing the marvelous purity of the land of the Buddha. Shariputra, this land of mine is pure, but you fail to see it. This land of mine is pure, but you fail to see it. And I just want to fall back on what Toni Morrison is saying. It's because we fail to see our own Buddha nature, that creates in us this tendency to create another and oppress that other in order to make ourselves whole. We manufacture our own thrill of belonging by casting others out. And I'm not just talking about them. I'm talking about us. Us superior leftists. Let us be very careful that we're not doing the same thing. You know, I could say that even in this loving sangha of sincere practitioners that we are, you can find that same dynamic. People seeking a richer definition of self, a better sense of me, by comparing myself negatively to someone else in the sangha, someone who has a different role. We can make the teachers other, or the shusos, or the priests, or those who have certain positions or jobs in the community. Or maybe just the way the person who's sitting next to us is sitting. He thinks he's a saint. We create a one-up, one-down situation, huh? And that's not different from the seeds that bloom in the sexism and racism that we see around us. The classism. It's not so different. It's the same activity. So in this community, I see the roles as being essentially self-selected. Those who like to enter through the problematic quality of words tend to study koans, and they are the ones that become shusos. Because the job of shuso is to approach and face the problematic situation with words. That's what it's about. So that's why they give talks. Because they have spent 5 or 10 years seeing how words just don't reach it, kind of reach it, could reach it, maybe don't. And so they're aware of the difficulty of words. Then we have people who are really attracted to ritual, who are moved by ritual, who experience ritual as a portal. And those are the ones who ordain. And that's all it's about. It's about somebody who, for some reason, completely irrational, but they become the ones that learn how to do the rituals so that something like what we're doing is organized in a way that makes sense for us, so that we feel that we can have this portal to something undefinable and that we can do it in a particular kind of way, that there's a form that can be followed. So those people tend to ordain eventually if they want to. And then there are the magnificent organizers, the people in our community that neither want to ordain or be shusos, they just want to take care of the community and organize, and they see this horrible disorganization, and they just want to go in and get it together for us all. So that's their role, and so they look like they're running things. Yeah, they are, thank goodness. We need that. So these are the elements that make our community strong and accomplished. And you know, we're looked at by many other communities as a model for practice, for lay practice. We're unusually successful in the way that we have been able to work. And it's because of those various roles that people have taken on. It's as if we've become what, in the words of the sutra, this magnificent one parasol that is composed of many small parasols. So at the beginning of the sutra, Vimalakirti finally appears. The Buddha takes up a lot of space, but Vimalakirti's our, you know, he's a human and he's a lay person and he's great. He's got a wonderful personality. You would like him. So the Buddha is teaching the Dharma to a huge crowd of distinguished disciples, monks, and bodhisattvas. So, you know, this is a Mahayana sutra, so there's tens of thousands of beings in a small space like this one. I love that part, that aspect of the Mahayana sutras. They're just like completely crazy upside down. So the Buddha preaches to this assembly, and 500 young people approach him, and they offer parasols, which is a custom, parasols, you know, umbrellas, that is the custom at the time, and lay these parasols at the Buddha's feet. So parasols, you know, are what protect from the sun and from the rain. They're protective things. And their shape is like the original Indian idea of what reality was. It was like a dome shape. So, and they lay those 500 parasols at his feet. Watson writes, translates, "The Buddha, with his supernatural powers, then caused all the jeweled parasols to come together and form one single parasol that spread over the entire 1,000,000,000-fold world. All the vast features of that world were visible there in the midst. All the Mount Sumerus of the 1,000,000,000-fold world, Snow Mountains, Muchalenda Mountains, Mahamuchalenda Mountains, and so on for a long, long list of mountains through several pages. The huge seas, rivers, and streams, fountains, and springs, as well as the suns, moons, stars, constellations, heavenly palaces, dragon palaces, and the palaces of the venerable spirits, all were seen within the one jeweled parasol." Imagine such a wonder. What's being conveyed here? It's not just a miracle. It's a vision of the non-dual. Of, you know, we talk about absolute oneness, interconnectedness. But to visualize it in the way that the sutra does, 500 multicolored, various shapes parasols, all with jewels on them, are all joined to form one single one that spread across the 100,000,000-fold world. And yet each one is whole and in itself, is visible and discernible, each one. So that's the core teaching, as I understand it, of the sutra. I mean, there's a lot of wonderful humorous and serious issues that are brought up by the Vimalakirti Sutra, but it always does come back to this one and this many, this one that's composed of this many. So I was recalling many years ago when we were still practicing here at Wisdom House, Sister Joanne, you may remember Sister Joanne, a fine photographer and artist, and worked with Sister Rosemary. She gave me shared with me this description that Thomas Merton wrote. And it's a really well-known piece of writing from Thomas Merton. And if you don't know who he is, he was a wonderful Catholic mystic and writer, and he was drawn to Buddhism towards the end of his life. He had a sudden death before he could convert to Zen, in my view. But Merton is really well known. One of the things is you know, he was kind of a rascal. He was a wild man in New York. He was a student at Columbia, and then he had this turn, this mystic turn. He really wanted to see it, get it, and he became a monk, and went away and just practiced in the Christian tradition, in the Catholic tradition, in order to get it, sounding much like some of naive young Zen any of us could associate ourselves with at some point. But he's writing. So he's in Kentucky at, I forget the name of the, Gethsemane, right, Gethsemane. He was there, and so he went to town, and he wrote this. In Louisville, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all these people, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. It was like waking from a dream of separateness, of spurious self-isolation in a special world, the world of renunciation and supposed holiness. The whole illusion of a separate holy existence is a dream. Not that I question the reality of my vocation or of my monastic life, but the conception of, quote, separation from the world that we have in the monastery too easily presents itself as a complete illusion. The illusion that by making vows we become a different species of being pseudo-angels, spiritual men, men of interior life, what have you. What? That's prajna. That's wisdom. He recognizes that he's not separate from others, that we are part of, that we function with, vertically and horizontally, through space and time. And this, what he's writing about, is the activity of prajna, of wisdom. The realization that our practice is skillful means is an upaya. It allows us to experience the other, not as a justification for ourself. Here's Merton again in the same piece. I'll just read one more piece from him. Then it was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts. The depths of their hearts where neither sin nor desire nor self-knowledge can reach. The core of their reality. The person that each one is in God's eyes. If only they could all see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way all the time. There would be no more war, no more hatred, no more cruelty, no more greed. I suppose the big problem would be that we would fall down and worship each other. Imagine such a thing. Huh? I would say that's a vision of a bodhisattva, an enlightening being who works using upaya, skillful means, to bring others to this insight. That's our work. Each time we feel ourselves desolate, lacking something, let's stop and recognize that we have all that is. We have it all. We are part of that wholeness, and we can be sustained by it, and we can sustain it. So I encourage you during this session to really look deeply at any time you have a wave of the other arising. Open your heart to the compassion, the suffering of the haters, and the separators of their suffering. Open your heart to your own heart. So I have Agatha. We take retreat to heal ourselves of separating, of making others, so that we can come home to just our own self. Everyone, and me too.